Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping investors save for retirement since 1937. For the latest retirement news, you can talk to your advisor, then visit rothirablog.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today was one of those days the economy decided not to cooperate. So how strong is the recovery, really? Also, healthcare in the South Bronx and the end of Wall Street. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you with us on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 15th of April today. And I think it's fair to say the national economic mood has brightened somewhat in the past few months. The labor market is on the mend. There is real growth in gross domestic product. Yes, I know the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy, but still, 11,000 is a promising number. And then we go and get days like today. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
The number of workers applying for unemployment benefits surged to nearly 500,000 last week. That's the biggest increase in 2 months. Home foreclosures jumped a record 19% in March, and industrial production for the same month was up slightly, but disappointed economists.
The reality is that this is a wimpy recovery.
Forecaster Jack Albertine says today's numbers reinforce his view that unemployment will stay above 5% for 3 or 4 years.
I don't think we're poised for a strong rebound. I think we're in a rut, basically, a very slow recovery.
But forecaster Macroeconomic Advisors is sticking with its prediction of a healthy 3.6% growth rate for the overall economy this year, even with today's numbers, says Ben Herzon.
Those particular data I would discount as statistical noise in an otherwise improving trend.
He says the stock market's rise, along with more stable home prices, is giving consumers the confidence to spend more. Retailers report healthy gains, although several lenders today said credit card defaults were on the increase. Wharton School professor Jeremy Siegel says there's still a dangerous undertow, but the economy will be able to swim out of it.
Not everything is going straight up, and we know the labor market has been extremely soft, and it'll take a while before that becomes a self-sustaining recovery.
And Siegel says a global recovery is underway that will help pull America up. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Europe took an economic hit today because of Iceland. No banks involved this time, just a volcano that exploded and sent millions of tons of rock and sand up into the atmosphere. Prevailing winds being what they are, that dust cloud traveled south and east and grounded planes in several European countries. Britain shut down its airspace. Norway, the Netherlands, and Ireland followed suit, as did parts of France. From the Marketplace European desk, Stephen Beard reports.
Volcanic ash and aviation don't mix. The tiny particles can clog up an engine. As the huge cloud of ash drifted high above northern Britain this morning, the air industry regulator banned all commercial flights. Bob Jones is the authority's head of operations.
Safety is our number one priority, and we won't be able to lift those restrictions until we're comfortable that it's safe to have aircraft fly with members of the travelling public again.
British airspace is the busiest in Europe. The closure hit 6,000 flights, stranding 600,000 passengers in the UK alone.
Basically, we're just told all flights have been cancelled. Nobody really to tell you what to do, you know, where to go. You know, it's really, really bewildering.
The cost of today's closure may be less than it seems. The airlines probably lost a few million dollars. And the insurance industry is not concerned. Spokesman Nick Starling says not every travel policy will pay out for delays due to volcanic ash.
There's no indication that this is a massive event. A lot of people are affected, but not all travel insurers will be paying out in this event.
Most of the airspace of Northern Europe will probably be open again tomorrow. If so, when the dust settles, the economic damage may be minimal. But the volcano in Iceland is still erupting. Another dust cloud could be on its way. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One of the many, many requirements of the new healthcare bill is that insurance companies have to show they're spending a certain amount of their revenue on actual care versus administrative costs and profits. Today, the Senate Commerce Committee said insurers have changed their accounting practices to make it look like they're spending more on patients than they actually are. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that.
Starting next year, insurers will be required to spend up to 85 cents of every premium dollar on actual patient care. Otherwise, customers get a rebate. The Senate report says the insurer WellPoint has already reclassified more than $500 million of administrative expenses as medical costs.
There's every incentive for insurers to try to move, you know, as much as possible into looking like it's medical spending.
Elizabeth McGlenn is a health policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. She says insurers might start by reclassifying things like brochures about wellness as patient care. Christine Ferguson is a healthcare analyst at George Washington University.
And the question becomes, is the point of this brochure more advertising than really education?
Right now, it's hard to know what qualifies as a healthcare expense and what doesn't. The healthcare overhaul will establish a national standard. Ferguson says this is a big gray area. For example, can insurers classify a 24-hour nurse hotline as patient care?
This is going to be kind of like the Supreme Court looking at pornography. You know it when you see it.
Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for America's Health Insurance Plans, a trade group. He's worried that federal regulators will take too narrow a view of what constitutes patient care.
Don't undermine programs that we know are working, programs that patients like and are relying on today.
Even if they can't be categorized as patient care. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, consecutive winning session at number 6. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Now, here's a thought on which to pin your economic hopes, that as Google goes, so goes the economy. The search engine giant announced this afternoon its revenue grew 23% in the first quarter of the year. The company credits what it calls a profound and positive trend in the online advertising business. Earnings did beat Wall Street expectations, but shares still fell in after-hours trading. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains there are some worries about how long Google can keep on topping itself.
It's as if the financial crisis was just a speed bump for Google. The company is back to its pre-recession earnings levels, but the challenges it faced then are the same questions being asked anew. How can a company that's based nearly all its growth on search advertising keep flying so high? Richard Fetico is an analyst with Merriman Curran and Ford. He points out most of Google's earnings still come from the same place.
We think that search still represents 90% of the business, and therefore, you know, some of the other things are really just noise at this point.
Other things, as in YouTube, the site that's responsible for 40% of all video traffic online, Google has added banner ads to YouTube's homepage and has made deals for original content. Fetico says that's helped some.
The monetization on the homepage and some of the original professional content has improved dramatically. Now, that hasn't changed the fact that the company is still very much driven by what happens in their core search business.
Another huge area of potential growth may yet be threatened by Google's ongoing spat with China. Sharvan Buskirk at Forrester Research thinks Beijing and Google will ultimately settle that dispute.
Google because China is such a huge opportunity, China because they want very badly to sort of move into a more industrial economy, become more of a global power and be recognized around the world as a modern force. So I think on both sides, over the next few years, we'll see compromise being reached.
In the meantime, today's results do offer investors short-term reassurance. Google's bread-and-butter business looks as strong as ever. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
If it's anything right now, the healthcare story is one that's got about a million different angles to it. Earlier, we talked about how insurance companies are adapting to the new rules. Now, a story about how places are changing. There's $15 billion in the healthcare bill to pay for healthier communities, to lower healthcare costs and fight disease by creating places to live that are better for you. If you grew up in the South Bronx in New York City, your chances of being overweight or having diabetes or being hospitalized for heart disease are frighteningly high. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY, Gregory Warner took a walk around town to see what changing that might take.
When he was 25 years old, Javier Lopez had a revelation. Growing up in the Bronx, he'd played basketball as a kid, but
you know, once you hit a certain age, you know, basketball stops, mom stops taking you to the little gymnasium right there, and then the destination points are either the corner store bodega or maybe going to a fast food restaurant.
Javier started gaining weight, a lot of it. He was on track to getting heart disease and early diabetes like his dad.
My cholesterol went really extremely high, and my doctor had told me, you know, you have to start taking better care of yourself.
And he did. Last week, he ran his first half marathon. Now 29, Javier directs the New York City Strategic Alliance for Health. The alliance sends federal funds to local pilot programs to fight obesity in Harlem and the South Bronx, like a plan to close residential streets for a couple of Saturdays so kids can bike and play outside. The new healthcare reform law includes $15 billion of prevention money over the next 10 years to help pay for local infrastructure projects to make it easier to be healthy. Things like bike paths, playgrounds, new sidewalks and streetlights. Because it's hard to get people to be active when just walking to a park means crossing several busy intersections.
This is chaos right here.
Well, this is an expressway going through a residential neighborhood.
Yep.
That voice you hear belongs to Shinpei Tsai, an urban planner and deputy director of transportation alternatives. We're on the corner of Willis Avenue and 135th Street. The plan is for the three of us to try to walk from here in the Bronx to the ball fields on Randall's Island, a mile away.
If you were a kid in the housing project and you heard about new ball fields on Randall's Island, wouldn't you want to try to get over there?
Randall's Island is an oasis of green in the middle of the East River, surrounded by Manhattan, Queens, and the Bronx. The whole thing is owned by the New York Parks Department. It's got baseball fields, bike trails, tennis courts, even a golf course.
Go over, or is it that way?
It's that way.
I follow Javier and Shinpei for seven deserted blocks, on broken sidewalks, no sidewalks, past auto body shops and the backs of warehouses with names like the Industrial Environmental Pollution Controls Corporation.
This is it. This is the fun part.
What is the fun part?
Well, I mean, we got to...
We're going to go on the highway, basically. We're going to be a pedestrian on the highway.
We climb up a concrete ramp and onto the Triborough Bridge. Actually, it's a little walkway on the edge of the bridge. Steel girders separate us from the eight lanes of cars. We walk with the Bronxkill River below us. Finally, the green fields of Randall's Island come into view.
If folks can see this right now, there are like six fields to our left that are totally unoccupied. And how many kids did we just see bouncing a ball, shooting hoops, playing double dutch? What do we need to do to get you out here? Because this is all yours. You know, this is yours for the taking. It's just it's convincing them that's the case. That's going to be a challenge that we have.
The challenge of making Randall's Island a part of people's lives is going to take more than building a safer way to get there. Behavior needs to change, too. And so some of the funds in the healthcare bill will pay for programs that get people moving, because all the walking paths in the world aren't going to force people off the couch.
Because sometimes I think we put the excuses in their mouths and saying, yeah, it's not safe, it's not this, it's not that. But sometimes it could be just simple, like, I just don't want to go.
That attitude is hard for any public health program to overcome.
Let's say we're doing a biking program in East Harlem, and all the adults get a coupon to Pathmark, right? The biking program runs through the summer. It ends. Coupons end. The next summer, people don't come out. They ask you, first thing they ask you, where are the coupons? And you can't do that no more.
Walking around the island this afternoon, it's pretty empty. There's a guy blasting music from his car, a girl's softball team warming up, a dad teaching his daughter how to ride a bike.
We're not trying to tell people how to be parents or how to live their lives. We're just trying to make it as easy as possible to be healthy.
Because ultimately, Javier believes in his own transformation and in others' ability to do the same. In New York, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Coming up, the tech unsavvy swarm the local library.
The user's a partner with the librarian. It's not, may I help you? It's like, we're going to do this together. And I think that's where things are going now.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials ticked up about 0.2% today. 21 points closed at 11,144. The NASDAQ hiked 0.4%, 10 points, 25.15 at the bell. The S&P 500 traded basically flat, closed at 12.11. UPS led the field, posting a 5.25% gain after it released good earnings numbers today. Rival FedEx popped up 1.7%. News that Continental Airlines and United Airlines have opened talks again lifted both company shares. Continental bounced 2.25%. UAL soared 5.25% today. Oil and gas explorer Mariner Energy gushed up nearly 42% today. That after details of rival Apache's plan to buy the company were made public by mistake. Oops. Apache shares drilled down 1.25% today. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.84%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for March. The National Restaurant Association Public Affairs Conference wraps up. Top policy issues include job creation and credit card interchange or swipe fees. And celebrate National Stress Awareness Day.
As if you don't have too much to do already.
I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Now that health care is done, Harry Reid seems to be ready to move on. The Senate Majority Leader said today he plans to bring a financial reform bill to a floor vote sometime next week. To really understand whether those changes might do any good in preventing crises to come, author Roger Lowenstein says it might be helpful to understand where we've been. His new book on how the crisis happened and where we go from here is called The End of Wall Street. Roger, it's really good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure to be on the show.
I'm going to try to sum up the basic thesis here of the first part of your book, which is, you know, going back to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and government regulations about housing and all of this, we basically did it to ourselves. We wanted people in houses and arranged regulations and the mortgage market so that that would happen.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. Every presidential administration has been a fan of owner-occupied housing. Fannie and Freddie obviously made it progressively easier to get a mortgage. But I don't want to leave out the notable contributions from the private sector people who, shall we say, worked so hard to distribute the mortgages that are now next to worthless.
Yeah, but so we had Robert Rubin, former Treasury Secretary and a very high official at Citigroup, testifying on Capitol Hill the other day, basically saying, "Hey, we didn't really know. We at the top levels had no idea any of this stuff was going on." You buy that?
You know, whose job was it? I mean, I know that Stan O'Neill had he ran Merrill Lynch, mm-hmm. had no idea of their exposure to mortgage CDOs. When the mortgage market shut down, he asked his top executives, "So how much of this stuff do we own?" And they said, "Well, Mr. O'Neill, we own $50 billion worth of it." And he knew then that the company was dead.
Were they willfully out of touch? Were they sitting there with their fingers in their ears, do you think?
You know, I think they were. They were out of touch with experience and the oldest lessons there are. Chuck Prince, of course, the CEO of Citigroup, said famously in 2007, "At some point, the music's going to stop, but it's playing now, and as long as it plays, we got to dance." Translation, we got to keep buying this stuff and putting it in our books and issuing these securities as long as the market's hot. Well, Kai, any kid of 6 years old knows that, and who's played musical chairs knows that when the music stops, not everybody gets a seat.
One of the things we've learned out of this is that maybe not everybody ought to be in a house, that maybe not everybody ought to be able to get a mortgage and follow that part of the American dream. But you raise a question or two about this idea of egalitarian capitalism. Don't we want a capitalism in this country that provides opportunity for people?
We want capitalism that provides opportunity. But what does that mean? Angelo Mozzillo, the head of Countrywide, was, beating the Hastings in the middle O's, saying every American ought to get a mortgage. And he meant every American, even if you couldn't put any money down. When you have capitalism without capital, it's really not capitalism. It's, I called him the Johnny Appleseed of mortgages because he was, distributing them in every backyard. But if people don't have any stake in the loan they're getting, if they haven't put up anything, then it's a kind of capitalism that's a house of cards. It's hard to call it anything other than a truly disgraceful episode in American banking.
Let me take you back to those months, actually, when Lehman Brothers was going under, the Dow was dropping 778 points in a day, and we really thought, everybody did, the end was coming to us and that really Wall Street was not going to function the way it did anymore. And obviously, that's sort of the premise of your book, The End of Wall Street, it's called. But here we are, 18 months later. The Dow's at 11,000. Banks are fat, dumb, and happy. Investors are clearly feeling better. The recession is grinding to a close. Is it really the end of Wall Street?
I think it's the end of Wall Street as we knew it then. Alan Greenspan said that derivative contracts, he said this in the late 90s, negotiated by private bankers, don't need to be regulated. I think it's going to be a long time before a Federal Reserve chairman says anything like that. The idea that bankers could set their own limits on debt, on capital, I think that's out the window. And I think and hope Congress is going to be doing something about that in the weeks ahead. The idea that bad recessions were a thing of the past, that we had landed on some nirvana of forever smoothly sailing economic progress, I think we all realize that Wall Street is risky again and economic life is risky again, something in the same way that I think, in a political sense, the end of history ended with 9/11. We're in choppy waters again.
Roger Lowenstein, his most recent book is called The End of Wall Street. More from Roger tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, what he thinks about financial regulation and what's going on Capitol Hill. Roger, thanks a lot for coming in.
Kai, it was a real pleasure.
This not necessarily economic statistic today in honor of this being National Library Week. The American Library Association says overall library use during the recession has risen as much as 23%. That means more people visiting, more people checking out books, using what libraries have to offer as they try to find jobs. From Colorado Public Radio, Zachary Barr reports.
Librarians meet guys like John Collins all the time. He's an unemployed security guard, and his approach to looking for work is old-fashioned. He gets out the yellow pages, flips to the S's, and calls security companies.
I'd say, "Are you guys hiring? Do you have any openings?" They said, "Yes, but you have to apply online for us to even consider you for employment."
So for help going online, Collins came to the Denver Public Library. But before he could send in even one application, he first had to learn
how to turn the computer on, how to, you know, check your email, how to make an email, passwords, everything.
Did you have an email account before you
started? I had nothing. I didn't know how to work a computer, period.
Librarians here have been so overwhelmed by people like Collins, they've had to reassess their services. Now, the Denver Public Library is offering one-on-one training with tech-savvy volunteers.
No space.
No space? Okay. Let me try again.
This year, the main downtown branch is expected to give nearly 1,000 private lessons, teaching basic computer and internet skills and how to write a resume.
Now, you can check here the availability for it, so go ahead and click on that.
With at least 15 million Americans out of work, libraries across the country have seen their own transformations. An Illinois library installed a new reference desk beneath a sign saying, "Your job search starts here." In North Carolina, public librarians from nearly every county came together to share ideas on helping the unemployed. And some big city libraries are renovating entire floors to make more space for job hunters. But Jason Kuhl from the Arlington Heights Memorial Library northwest of Chicago says there's a limit to what he and his colleagues can do.
People would come in and they would think we could review their resume. And that's just not what librarians do. We're not experts in that.
So instead, Kuhl recruited HR professionals to review the resumes. And that's a librarian for you, someone who knows how to get things done. According to Tula Giannini, the dean of the Pratt School of Information and Library Science in New York City, librarian skills are a perfect match for the times.
Our field now is sort of intermeshed with probably the most dramatic things happening in our culture, which is the digital revolution, and we're right at the heart of that. And so there's much more that we can do now.
Consequently, Pratt's tweaking its curriculum to make sure aspiring librarians know how to use social networking sites and handheld e-gadgets. It's an interactive profession now, Giannini says, one where the library users, particularly job seekers, should be prepared to give as much as they get.
The user's a partner with the librarian. It's not, may I help you? It's like, we're going to do this together. And I think that's where things are going now.
Another direction things are headed? Shrinking budgets. Many libraries are facing severe cuts or even closing down. Though they may not care to admit it, some librarians might need these job-seeking skills themselves one day. In Denver, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. By Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, April 15th, tax day, as I'm sure you know, but what I'm about to say is going to do nothing to soothe your 1040-induced stress. A research group at Syracuse University says its data shows the number of big company tax returns the IRS has audited is down 20% over the past decade. You can, however, take some solace in this. The IRS says it does audit every single firm with more than $20 billion in assets, which at least in theory means the big Wall Street banks are going to be getting some special attention from the tax man. You got till midnight to get your return postmarked. Not a moment to waste now. Off you go. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped up 21 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ took on 10 points. That is 0.4%. The S&P 500, well, we'll call that one flat. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow for the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, for those of you who don't think there's money to be made in YouTube...
I am running a business based on my son's viral video, David After Dentist.
It's actually pretty cute. You should see it. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.